Force field is at 25% strength.
Booster ignition is go.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi Podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Auto sequence start in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi Podcast.
Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava protocol and Hart protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism an ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Shaughnessy. I help lead Delphi Ventures and one of the podcast hosts here. Today, I'm thrilled to have on our fifth guest for our VC crypto series, Santiago. Santiago, how's it going?
Hey, Tom. How's it going? Great to be here.
Good, man. Love having you on. Tell us a bit about yourself and your firm.
Yeah, I'm a partner at Parify Capital. We're a DeFi-focused fund. We've been around for 3 years. Like to get really, really involved in projects and be, if I were to succinctly describe what we do, is we like to be a community-first fund that is also an active user in DeFi. And I think those two things really encompass what we do here. I've been investing in the space since 2012, discovered Bitcoin. My background's in game theory, so to me, that was fascinating. I'm from Mexico, and so really a lot of combination of this nagging thing that finance hasn't been modernized, and it's always been haunting me. And so that has been kind of my life mission is to make finance better through crypto.
It's awesome, man. I love to hear it. I actually didn't know your background was in game theory. Were you like working in that world, or was it more studying? Or
yeah, no, this was in school. I remember taking my first class in game theory. I was econ major, and I thought this is great because you don't actually have to memorize anything. It's more about thinking strategically. And it encompasses a lot of things that I really like human psychology and strategy and playing iterated games. And if folks have seen, I guess, the movie Beautiful Mind, which talks about like Soviet era, like Kennedy versus, I think it was Gorbachev or about like all these negotiations. And I think crypto really is so multidisciplinary, and so is game theory. So, yeah.
Hell of a movie, man. I mean, outside of him being, you know, having some mental stuff, but I didn't know it was your background. And it's a great parlay into crypto because, I mean, you use it probably with everything you think about.
Yeah, it certainly is super applicable.
So let's dive right into it, Santiago. So I want to start at the beginning. You see a zillion plays all day. I've asked everyone this question, but how do you curate what you want to look at, how much time you spend on each project, and, you know, just filtering? There's just so much going on.
It's a great question because, you know, most people are surprised to hear that Parify is a very small team. Like up until last year, we were a team of four on the investment side. And we're just covering a lot of ground. I'll tell you what has been the most important thing that I think of is having a very clear thesis and focus. And for us, it was just from the get-go is, look, we think that the main thesis that I think is the most value in crypto will accrue in financial functions. And so that is very clear for us, for founders. When they come to us, they know that it's because we're investing in DeFi. And for the most part, it's all we do. And we stay in our lane. I think that's been difficult. When I was before Parify, I was investing, you know, in the space. And I think the ambition of we can decentralize so many things and the use cases are vast. that having focus is just keeps you, you know, you stay in your lane. And by the time that I talk to a team, I've already developed a thesis of, hey, here are the things that need to be built in DeFi that are, that have been built, but are not working well. And I think it really stems from being an active user. So actually using these protocols informs my thesis, because if I don't use it, it's hard for me to conceptualize how other people will use it. And so I think that really crystallizes my thesis as to, once I talk to a founder, I already have a very clear view on the things that I want to invest. And at that point just becomes, is this the right person? Is this the right team?
So that's a great answer. And it's a unique one, because you're not reacting to what teams are bringing you, right? You're saying, hey, I already have a thesis. I know what I want to see built. But how do you meld that with the stuff that you're not thinking about? What, how do you, when you see a project you didn't even think about would fit in your thesis or solve a niche, how do you change your mental grasp to say, hey, you know what, here's my thesis, here's what I want to see, but you know, this is also cool?
It's a great question, because honestly, it's the hardest thing, right? Because in this space, I'll give you a trend. So like metaverse and play to earn, huge theme that I think is going to transform at this intersection of DeFi, NFTs. And I think it's just keeping an open mind. I mean, I think like maximalism just is going to be hurtful at some point in this industry. And invariably, I don't know why people ossify their thinking when the reality is this space, because it is open source, moves a million miles an hour. And so you have to always keep some perspective of constantly updating your models. And it's a very data rich environment. So you're, you know, if I see traction, if I see users buying a lot of NFTs in Flow or some of these other applications in OpenSea and Punks, then I'm going to join that Discord. And it's like, well, it's almost like if you walk into the library, right? When I was in school, you go into Barnes and Noble, that of course they no longer exist. But the best part of it is you walk in there, and you always, you know, you love fiction. So you go to the fiction aisle, always, for the most part, or you like nonfiction. But every once in a while, I think you have to make a conscious effort of going to an aisle when there's a lot of people that you might not even care about and take an interest in, and saying, why are these people here? Because clearly they're seeing value here. And I think keeping that open-mindedness has served me well in crypto, in particular, identifying, you know, NFTs. And metaverse, like Axie, for instance, you guys are super involved in, or Illuvium, some of these things. I think if you just strictly say DeFi is just financial functions, it's how Wall Street exists, you're going to miss things like flash loans. You're going to miss things like at this intersection of making NFTs somewhat financial, like the financialization of NFTs and digital scarcity. And so anyways, long-winded answer, but yeah, you always have to keep an open mind, right? And constantly talk to founders, because that's what ultimately those guys are at the ground level.
I love your analogy to Barnes & Noble fiction, and I love that you keep it open. I mean, we're the same way, man. We're invested all over the map, bunch of layer ones, bunch of apps built on top. But just to dig in there a little further, how do you actually keep an open mind in practice? Because I mean, let's say you got started when ETH was taking off, you're invested in all these Ethereum-based projects, you spend most of your day learning more about them, tracking their, you know, their progress. And over time, you that's your muscle memory. You say, hey, you know what, Axie's crushing it because X, Y, Z, like I don't want to talk to a game on Solana. Like, How do you keep an open mind in practice?
My best advice is you always have to think in probabilities, never in binary terms, for everything in life. And I think that can be really frustrating in relationships and stuff like that, right? But
it is in relationships. Yeah.
But generally speaking, like, you know, you always think in probabilities, right? There is a greater than 0% chance that some other layer one will be the de facto, will supplant Ethereum, or that it won't be as competitive. It will be complementary. And so, look, I mean, I think like there's a natural bias to a confirmation bias of things that you've invested in that you want to protect. And the way I've orchestrated in our committee and our diligence process at Parify is one where I try to minimize, when I was thinking about it, I try to minimize these confirmation biases. So for instance, no two partners can be in the same call. For the most part, it's one person in the Parify team that will lead the process and will mostly interact with the team. But you know, I'll give you an example. So if I'm talking to Project X and there's an analyst in the call, the way that I'm asking the questions will influence his ability to raise questions. You know, like every question, the questions that you ask dictate the kind of answers that you get. And so if Nick or Andre to my team sees me excited by the intonation of my voice because they've gotten to know me, well, the chances are that they're not going to probably object to the fact that it might be a terrible project, right? It's just sort of like how the world works.
That's incredible. That's an incredible strategy to have. I've never even thought about that. Yeah.
So I always tell teams, look, it's not that like a partner will not like give you attention. It might be me sometimes that I'm going to drive all the diligence beginning to end. And there's two or three iterations of questions of Q&A. So I'll talk to a team, then I'll condense my notes in my memo. I'll send it to the team. They can then ping me for questions independently. They can't share all the questions with everyone publicly, because I want to see the kind of questions that people are asking also to value independent thinking and defer judgment as much as possible. So we do maybe two or three iterations of Q&A. I go back to the team, I respond. And then over time, we score, right? Independent scores, submit privately. And then I rank against their curve and the composite curve. So in order to make an investment, it needs to have aggregate score of X. And, you know, your 7 might be different than my 7. So ultimately, what all of this is designed to do is to make sure that we do not. So for instance, kind of like quadratic voting, if there is someone in my team that feels really strongly about a particular theme or idea or project, it's going to be surfaced to a greater extent. And probabilistically, we're not going to miss that through this process. It's not perfect, but at least it's better.
No, I love your process. I mean, you're basically accounting for people that are better salespeople than others here, right? I mean, like if you're Santiago and you're in a call and you love something, who the hell is going to say no, right? But your way, right. you cut down leading, you cut down, and you also cut down a lot of partner time, right? There's like no need to have 10 people on one call. Yeah.
No, it's very clinical too. And people have ownership over the investment as opposed to when you delegate and transfer like responsibilities, when you're doing diligence, I think it creates more surface area and vectors where you're going to miss stuff.
So, I mean, it works really well on, so I love your process from finding investments because you're not leading, you're not pushing your thoughts on somebody else before they have the time to do the due diligence. But how do you get the buy-in for the projects post-investment? Because what I've seen a lot of times, like even at Delphi, like when we have a lot of people really excited about a project, it really helps them because they follow the story, you know, past the investment.
Yeah. Like, so for instance, if I'm running Point and I want to give other people in my team involved in the project, or is that more the question?
Yeah, I feel like if you only have one person doing the due diligence, it's hard to get that visceral buy-in on a hard play, mm-hmm. right?
No, it's a good question because at some point we do bring the entire team. So before we make any investment, the team comes in for 30 minutes or an hour and presents to the entire team. And it's a very much more meet and greet at that point. Like we know that we're going to make the investment. They know that we're going to make the investment. It's like, okay, here's the rest of the Parify team that's been on the background. Got a lot of the questions. So they get to know us very well. And yeah, it's sort of like a... Yeah, we definitely do that before we do the investment.
Do you have every, like, let's say there's certain people on your team. Like, let's say there's, I think you mentioned 4 earlier, right?
Now it's grown a bit, but yeah, it's 6 in the investment team.
God, yeah. I didn't know. I thought you guys had a bigger team. You guys really made a name for yourself. It's awesome. And does everybody have the same scoring? Like, because obviously people look at things different ways. Like the way I look at a community might be different than the way you look at a community. How do you guys account for that?
It's a great question. At the moment, we score like aggregate scores. Like it's just, it's not like, maybe we should probably incorporate this, but like different kind of dimensions to sum up to one composite score. But yeah, I think each person, you sort of have the view that in their mind, they're doing their calculation, right? They're 7 and they're factored in. And it's always, a lot of times it's like, hey, how would you compare this opportunity to X or Y that you felt was a 7 or was a 9? And I think it's on a relative basis, but yeah, that's how we do it at the moment. But it's actually a good idea to create more different dimensions.
Yeah, I'd love to dive into those 7 or the key parts you have. I mean, one of the biggest things I look for is obviously the founding team is big. How do you size up a founding team both quantitatively, but also qualitatively? Because on a couple of these episodes before yours, everybody loves passionate founders, but there's always like that miss of someone that might be a passionate founder, but that you just might not personally like or might not personally vibe with, but they might also just be crushing it. So how do you deal with those blind spots? How do you size up and get conviction in the team?
You know, it's a great question because I have encountered those situations. Maybe I'm thinking of an example where I didn't necessarily love the founder, but I think the common denominator across most founders or all founders that I'm invested in is that they have some sort of unique insight that illuminates some sort of perception of a particular problem. And they've been thinking about it for a long time and they come at you and they say, okay, here's how I'm thinking about solving X or Y. And you're like, huh, okay. Like it almost seems so obvious. And so those, when you sort of see that, it's like, okay, it's not always the case, but when you see that, it's like, hold on to it, right? And invest behind that. But there are times where it's not as clear. And I think it just depends on the opportunity. I think for instance, there might be a team that, for instance, I didn't feel was like super, I guess, technical. But they had all the relevant experience for BD and partnerships and integrations and had sort of a leg up that sometimes in this space helps a lot, right? You have the first mover advantage, you have, you know, some sort of grant or some sort of relationship that is unique. And so, but yeah, it's I'm trying to give you a concrete answer. I love to talk to a founder and just spend as much time with him, asking him questions about all kinds of stuff. And that is not just sometimes I'll throw like stuff that's like not even related to crypto. And just thinking about, hey, what have you changed your mind on recently? Like, what is it that interests you? Like, I really want to understand the why that they're doing this stuff. Because
the why is important.
The why. Like, at some point, this industry is going to, like, knock you down. And it's very sometimes demoralizing. I don't know if we're in a bear market right now, but we will be at some point. And I think, like, just making sure that team is going to build through and through. And A lot of it is pattern recognition and instinct, which I appreciate is might not be like very useful for someone listening to this podcast. But if I were to just concretely like say it's a unique insight. Also, like, I mean, the last thing I'll say is keeping it open, back to this idea of like keeping an open mind. For instance, like Hayden didn't have financial background, or I don't think he was like a coder. He learned to code like on the fly and built Uniswap, which is like the most successful, I think, DeFi protocol, like pound for pound. And so Vitalik was like a Cointelegraph, I think, or a Bitcoin magazine. So like, you know, I think a lot of people like want to look back and say, oh yeah, I saw that founder, it was so obvious. But it's really not. Like a lot of time, you know, this idea that if they're attacking a big problem, they might not be the best team today, but over time, I think they have sort of the values, the drive, the motivation to just outcompete everyone else. And that might be the winning factor.
I'm with you there. I mean, the way I learned the best is taking a non-video 2-hour call with a founder, walking around, not having to stare at them and just listening and having that conversation. I can't even, frankly, I'm not smart enough to get it on group calls. I just don't have the buy-in. You know, it's I totally get where you're coming from there. And shifting gears a little bit, like let's say you're not Santiago at a VC, right? And frankly, you have great access, but let's say you're, you know, the 7,000th retail investor in Uniswap. How do you expect them, or how should they go about getting comfortable with Hayden, the founder? Like, where do they get the insight to get comfortable when they might not have access to the core team or the core community?
Go on the Discord. Most founders are very, very accessible, like extremely accessible. You can, it's like mind baffling how very little. I've been on Sushi AMA calls with the entire Sushi dev team, and there's 10 people in the YouTube stream. It's sort of crazy, right? Because you think about like traditional markets where like the CEO and the management team presents, and there's like thousands of analysts dialing in, and one or two maybe has a chance of asking a very cookie cutter question, right? On a very specific thing. And it's always the analyst, JP Morgan or Goldman. And in this case, like there's just an incredible amount of access in this industry. I'll tell you the truth, I don't buy this argument that like, yeah, okay, sometimes institutional capital has some sort of structural advantage and what have you, right? Like people ping us, and if you don't have a reputation or whatever, they might not ping you. But I've seen over and over again, like people that are just early in Discord channels and are talking directly to founders. How the founder, even stuff like at what time is he logging in? How active is he in Discord? Like, how does he respond to heat and moments of pressure? Tom, how many Discords have you been where like things just blow up, right? It's either during launch or after launch and things are never perfect. And it's how they respond in moments like that that I think you start to understand the moral fiber of a founder and how accessible he is. Like, man, Kane, Stani, all these guys are super active on Discord and governance forums are always on podcasts. Like, they're always on like Twitter spaces or clubhouses. You know what I mean? It's very accessible. So
you're right. And I misspoke with the community. I mean, anybody could access the community. You're totally right. But getting that conviction in the founders, you definitely can do from retail that you really can't do in traditional markets. My next follow-up question for you is, the whole goal of crypto is to have community run and owned networks. I think what we're kind of seeing in crypto is that the traditional corporate structures actually make sense because coordination issues with thousands of people is just frankly hard. But I think the goal is eventually for these founders to decentralize away to the community and have real ownership. Do you think that is an actual viability for these founding teams to eventually go away?
I don't think so. I am very much a believer in decentralizing and creating a structure of nodes, semi-autonomous, independent nodes that are processing information and have some degree of autonomy to make decisions. And so I'm a big believer in that. But I also think that there sometimes top-down is very influential and is necessary to create some sort of structure. And I think that's a way like humans coordinate and organize. Otherwise, it's too chaotic. I think it's sort of like a parabola, right? Like progressive decentralization works at different moments. You can't decentralize out of the gate because then nothing gets done. There needs to be some sort of direction and leader that attracts and builds a community. Like you talk about building a community. Well, like if you have a really talented leader like Andre or like Stani or Kane, like these guys like have gravitas that brings and pulls in people. And then from there, like progressively you start decentralizing and community members step up. But there is a time where like if you truly like decentralize, like Synthetix, for instance, like their Spartan Council. Great idea. I think like Synthetix as a protocol has been probably the farthest along in terms of decentralized, like credibly decentralized. But I think sort of Kane issued a post like not too long ago that says, I'm back because I need to come back. And I think that's helpful at times, right? And it might be moments of crisis. It might be moments where the protocol needs more direction or more implementation. And so I think like you can solve a lot of these things with things like coordinate or like just mechanism and tooling that I think is super at the cutting edge of how do you coordinate a lot of these resources and talent. But I am a believer that you do need some sort of like benevolent dictator at some point to kind of carry the team forward.
I'd say it's a hot take, but I mean, I agree with it. I gave this example before, but like, I don't think a smart contract dev on a project really wants to deal with the coordination issues of rounding up people to vote on something. Like, it just makes operational sense. I guess the difference, though, is when we think about it, if we have these operational hierarchies within DAOs, I mean, what's the real difference versus traditional corporate structures, right? I mean, at a quick glance, I would never have access to Verizon's CEO, but meanwhile, Kane is on Synthetix's Discord. So it's clearly more approachable. But at the end of the day, isn't it just the same thing?
I don't think so. I ultimately think that the key difference here is like a Heisenberg principle, which is people know that they're observing. People know that in open source, it is radically competitive. People can fork your code. People can move. And you've seen that happen over and over, right? I mean, Sushi is a good example. For what it is, Uniswap didn't have a token. They launched, and Sushi has grown into a credible, what I would say, blue chip DeFi protocol. You know, it was as a result, some people like have theories that it was largely because Uniswap didn't have a token, and then governance has been somewhat underwhelming for a few folks. And I think that the key premise of open source systems is that anyone can come and go. No one's holding a really talented. When talent moves freely, as freely as possible, then it creates this sort of like implicit motivation for everyone to stay honest and to operate to the best of their abilities, right? Because they're sort of like a Pareto, where like if I start becoming too much of a dictator and too top down and micromanage, the best guys are going to leave, right? It happens in traditional world, but in open source systems, you know, there's a lot of really smart devs that can make a living and get grants and start working on multiple protocols and have their hands on many communities. That I think that is what keeps everyone on the edge, right? You can never truly be an asshole. You can't be, pardon my friends, but you can't be like, you know, there's a difference between power and force, right? I think in traditional world, in governments, in corporations, there's a lot of force. There's like man-made monopolies, there's artificial like boundaries and all this stuff. But true power, I think, comes through decentralization, where information flows freely, capital flows freely, human capital flows freely, and ultimately everything is forkable. So that, I think, is, look, you're never going to be in a perfect system. There's always friction. But I think the idea of an open source system that is as frictionless as humanly possible, it keeps everyone honest and playing an iterated game. And so I don't know if that makes sense, but that's
no, no. It totally makes sense. I guess the thing that scares me, or I guess I'm just uneasy about, is that long grind back to the traditional world, right? Like where people are, you know, potentially realize less and less in communities. We realize, hey, one person's making a decision. They don't really care what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm getting out of what you're saying is that if people feel that they're not being listened to by these, let's say, crypto, you know, leaders, they'll just leave.
Yeah. Well, look at what's going on in Sushi right now in the forum. Very contentious OTC deal. And the community has spoken very clearly. There was a long call yesterday. There's been a lot of discussion in the governance forum. I think anyone would be remiss to overlook that.
Yeah.
If you're the dev team, if you're investors, if you're anyone that has vested interest in Sushi, or just an observer, will look at that and say, hey, wait a minute. This is like a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting, and it's quite contentious. And it's not just people telling you how the company is going to work the next year and where they're going to invest. No, it's real stuff. And people vote with tokens, right? And so I think this is where I think the true value of governance tokens comes into effect. You know, obviously, there's a lot of people that speculate governance tokens don't have any value, but you're seeing it very clearly right now. And the Uniswap like grant giving, like all of these things, I think are illustrating how, you know, at the end of the day, there is a lot of value in governing these systems.
Using your example on Sushi, the community, if they're unhappy with the OTC deal, they'll probably, a lot of them will leave, right? If Verizon Wireless launches a new wireless plan that I don't like, I'm not going to sell my stock, right? Like, I don't care. Like, why do you think people have such a financial, you know, decision-making process based on the decisions of the protocol? Whereas in the traditional world, if there's a decision people don't like, they don't really react. They don't really care.
Oh, yeah, easy. They have skin in the game. That's it.
That's true. Like, but I mean, what if I own Verizon stock though? I mean, like I wouldn't care. Like if I had 10 grand of Verizon stock and 10 grand of Sushi, Verizon releases something I don't like, I really don't care. But if the Sushi deal goes bad, screw it. I'm out. I'll just buy Uniswap in 2 seconds. Like maybe it's the ease of transfer, or I don't know. Maybe it's the more buy-in. I don't know.
I think so. It's a good question. Like I haven't thought about it much, but it is a very competitive system, right? And so it also attracts, at the moment, it's sort of like, crypto is relatively small. And so it is attracting these sort of like hobbyist fanatics that feel really passionately about things. Who knows how it will look like in 5 years or 10 years, right? A lot of this might just be like proxy voting and not people just not even noticing or caring about these things. But there will be protocol governors that, you know, are represent their constituents, whoever they may be. And yeah, you know, I think... my appreciation for crypto, forget about DeFi, forget about Bitcoin, just at the very, very core, I think it's just open source systems attract smart people. And smart people want to work on difficult problems. And they also have strong views and they want to be heard. And anytime that someone could be heard and there's a platform, there's a forum, it's very empowering for people. Again, it's this idea of power versus force, right? And so I think ultimately it creates an environment where people are more comfortable to voice their opinion and to act on their opinions because they have a thing called a token that they can exercise and very clearly vote on snapshots or allocate resources. And it is very empowering, right? I mean, it's pretty crazy, but like, you know, DeFi is not a small industry anymore. Look, I'll be critical. Some protocols, there's a lot of like, a lot of idea that it's decentralized and it's community. And the reality is it's not, right? It's very centralized and the team controls and exercises a lot of power. And look, that might be the case early on, but I would say my thesis is if a team is not really focused on transferring some sort of autonomy and power and voice to the community, it's never going to be a successful protocol. In fact, I won't invest in behind that because people, I think, given the choice, Tom, between being in a protocol that takes you in mind and consideration and credibly gives you a platform to voice your opinion versus one that doesn't, well, you're probably going to pick the former, not the latter.
No, I totally agree with you. And to go back to my question, I mean, you answered it great. I mean, the reason why I would want to quickly sell sushi versus sell like Verizon stock is because I have not only, I have ownership in both financially, let's say, but the point is that like, I'm a part of this story. I'm a part of this community. I've seen it built from the get-go. So you have that, this is kind of really mine. Whereas a corporation is just like, it's somebody else's. I'm just a small part of it. So that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I guess, Santiago, just switching gears a little bit, a lot of what you do is you spend a lot of time in the projects that you invest in. You spend a lot of time in the space. I'm assuming that you're pretty concentrated with your investments, but I would love to get your take on concentration versus diversification. I guess one from a sizing perspective, so you know your portfolio, but also a time perspective because you need to spend time on the projects you own because that's what will affect your performance. But you obviously want to obviously be aware of everything new that's launching.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the initial idea you asked me about. Like, I think you always have to keep an open mind of making certain investments, while they may be relatively small in the aggregate, that give you a toehold position to have an incentive to learn about something. So for instance, this is how I think I've approached investing in crypto early on. Initially, it was like, hey, a college course in America costs $2,500. I'm going to invest that amount exactly in Bitcoin to learn about it. And you extrapolate and you extend that further and you say, well, in many instances, you know, you want to have seed bets in things that are more exploratory, experimental on the fringes that may or may not work. But you know, over time, I've observed that maybe we invested in something that was too early 2 or 3 years ago. But that experience may have not worked out well, but that kind of allows us to identify a better founder with a better idea morphed into now. So I'll give you an example. I passed on Thorchain for a number of reasons. And I've now invested in a different protocol because I think it has a better team, it has better structure, it has a more credible path towards credibly decentralizing and creating more security in the nodes, in the system, and has a better front end. It's always been nagging me. It's like, well, shit, I missed Thor. It would have been a fun returner for all I know. And then I apply that to saying, okay, well, I'm going to constantly be looking at something that, and observe that, right? Because a lot of times when you miss something, you don't want to look at it. It's like, oh man, like it's just really, really painful to look at your misses. But to me, I obsess it to some extent about them, right?
Santiago, yeah. Since you're so easy to talk to, I'll push back on one point. I mean, I'm a huge fan, obviously, investor of Thorchain, the community, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But we've also made other bets and competitors, like, you know, Chainflip is a team I love, right?
There we go. Yeah, we invest in Chainflip.
Exactly. So, I mean, just zooming back out, like how much of it is playing catch up though? Like if you lose on an investment, and I've lost and missed plenty, and I found something that will take its place or be better, how much of it is backfilling? Like, hey, you know what? They're going to crush them. I'll do this versus, you know what? Maybe I should take the money and just invest it in the one I missed. Maybe there's, you know, they have product market fit. They're launched. They're live. Like, how do you revisit it without like the bit of skepticism or the bit of bias there?
Yeah. So, okay. So great question. I'll say one thing. And then from first principles, I'm a big believer in making multiple bets in a particular category.
I agree.
Full stop. Some teams take object. Now I'm very upfront. I'm like, look, I'm going to invest in a theme and it's A, not winner take all. B, this space allows me to do that. It's open source and it's very competitive. So I'm not, in traditional VC, you can only invest in Uber or Lyft. Okay. But I think in crypto, I'd be remiss not to make multiple bets in a particular theme because A, it's so early. I don't know if we're in 1980, 1990, 2000, 2008. I just don't know. And look, some teams are like, look, this is too close to home. You have multiple investments in an options protocol. I don't want to be the third options protocol. I said, that's fine. We won't invest. Ultimately, I'm not sharing insights between portfolio companies. I mean, that'll be sabotaging my reputation. You know what I mean? Like the last thing I do is like, I call Robert the compound. Hey, look, this is what I heard from Stani. It's like, no, there are in each in their own way, AMMs that are attacking, I think, and taking a different approach, right? And that's fine. You know, I'm very comfortable doing that. And I think as a fiduciary, this is what I do. Like, I want to make the best risk-adjusted returns, like in my portfolio. So at the end of the day, yeah, I'll make multiple bets in a particular category. To your question around catching, like playing catch up, I'll push back and say some of the best investments are the second or third wave of a particular idea, right? Instantiation. Look at Instagram. My God, I mean, there were so many picture sharing apps before Instagram. It was just the right time. It was very nuanced features that just made Instagram so cool. The filters, like no one had filters, just Instagram gave you filters. And you're like, anyone with a crappy phone that is a terrible photographer could turn crappy photos into, wow, this is share worthy. And but you had the distribution channel of Facebook and you had all these platforms, right, to share. In a similar manner, I think like, you know, options, for instance, is a category that hasn't taken off at DeFi. For whatever reason, options, no one has cracked that nut yet. Someone will. So I'm looking at that and saying, okay, there's different versions of it. Let me make different bets in the category, right? And so some of the best investments I made are the second or third wave of that.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, we did Zapper and DBank. We did a bunch of protocols because, I mean, they're launching on different L2s. They have different target markets. They have different pricing algorithms. They're very technical.
DBank's much more focused on Asia, right? Zapper is much more like Western. You look at the demographics, right? So you call Seb and say, hey, look, I'm investing in DBank. Like, any problem with that? Like, yes, okay, well, we won't, right? And that's it.
So the other question I have for you, you brought up a good point. Sometimes it is the second or third wave of an idea that takes off. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because the first mover like brought the idea about and got people comfortable and the second dominated? Is it specific per project? Is it they're tweaking features? Or is it that the original teams just can't adapt fast enough and the second one is a complete rebuild that addresses everything that the first one screwed up?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a little bit of everything. It depends on, but I'll give you an example. For instance, Maker. Maker is like the bedrock. It's the central bank of DeFi. But you talk to the guys and they're like, you know what? Because we were first, so many other teams have learned from the pitfalls that we've had. And Maker is not a perfect system, right? And they would be the first ones to tell you probably. But in conversations, you know, they're like, yeah, it's sort of, I sympathize with founders because they build a lot of stuff and you hard code certain things in the protocol, right? This goes back to the idea of immutability. You synthetics early on, right? When it was, I was hoping like the Haven team then turned synthetics, like redesigned their token and staking. Like this is like a new frontier and we didn't really have examples, right? Now when I talk to a protocol, it's like, well, you borrow a lot of elements from so many different protocols, from Aave staking module and Maker and synthetic staking and the liquidity mining of Compound and how it's attracted TVL, but maybe hasn't been the best vesting schedule. And so I think it's both the beauty and the curse of open source systems, right? Because as a founder, it must be really difficult to go first, launch, get traction, and then someone come in and say, I like this piece of your code. I'm going to borrow that from all these different elements and construct a better puzzle to attack a different opportunity. And, you know, I think you just sort of like take the, it's easy for me to say, it's obviously not easy for a founder, like the Isaac Newton approach, which is, you know, everyone ultimately is standing on the shoulders of giants, easier said than done, right? Because it must piss everyone off that someone comes in and forks and does a vampire attack. And I understand that. And it might be really difficult. I think there's ways of doing and borrowing stuff. But going back to Maker, I think, you know, there are a lot of different experiments in decentralized stablecoins, liquidity, was it liquidity, like Rye, you have obviously the ESD, DSDs of the world and Fei. And so I think to me, that's just a testament of we're very, very early and ultimately everyone's going to keep borrowing stuff, but it is difficult. I guess the more difficult and challenging thing of all of this is that sometimes you're required to codify your monetary policy, your inflation curve, your certain things that you can't change as easily, right? And you make a mistake that could really handicap your ability to grow.
Santiago, that's an excellent question, excellent answer. Still processing, it's incredible. And I mean, another question I have though for you on that topic is, a lot of investors, including myself, like to invest in new code, new ideas, new things. But to your point, a lot of the new projects are basically copy and paste of old projects put together. Where does the line blur between copy and pasting old things that worked and then actually having a new idea?
Great, great question. So topical too, because you're seeing it in Solana right now. Yeah. A lot of ideas that have been tried in Ethereum that were not viable because it's just a different environment, right? When you think about the three different trade-offs that you make in a protocol, right? Security, decentralization, and speed or throughput. And so, or I might have got one of them wrong, but you know, I've been a hackathon judge in the last like three hackathons in Solana. And it's incredible to see, you know, a lot of it is, I remember in the discussions, like, should this project win? Well, it's just a copy paste of X, right? That exists in DeFi and Ethereum. I was like, well, wait a minute. My question is always, well, what are the applications that have been tried in Ethereum, haven't worked because of structural reasons of the L1 that will work in Solana, right? Maybe prediction markets, maybe auction protocols, maybe more retail facing stuff, maybe games, maybe what have you, right? And so, you know, I think that's fine, right? You borrow things. The nice thing about like crypto and software in general is that you don't need to build and reinvent the wheel for everything, right? This is the problem with crypto. Like a lot of times we try to get too complicated and nerdy about vesting schedules and we just totally blow it out. Like totally, it's a total screw up. It's like, guys, vesting schedules exist in traditional world, in traditional startups, and they work, right? They retain, like there's, you don't need to reinvent the wheel on that. Focus on things that matter the most, right? So yeah, and Solana is a good example of that, I think, where you're seeing a lot of innovation, a lot of re-experimentation and borrowing, kind of like reinvested in like Jet Protocol, which is like a money market. They're, one of the devs worked at Maker, and so he has a lot of experience there. And he just said, look, I made this decision to build in Solana for X and Y. And I think this will work better here. I was like, okay, that's good.
No, that's a great answer. I mean, we're the same way. We've made a bunch of bets on Solana. We've made a bunch of bets on Ethereum, on specific L2s just to build within that ecosystem. My other question for you, though, is how do you make that bet, or how do you make bets on Solana, for instance, or other layer ones, when there are answers on existing L1s to solve that? And I'll give you examples. Like, you know, we did DYDX, we did MCDEX, we did Vega, right? All perps and more complex financial derivatives on L2s on Ethereum. Vega is its own chain, but we don't have to really get into it. But that's if right. You're investing on Solana, like you're kind of attempting to solve that niche, but it's already being kind of addressed on ETH on L2s, but they're not really launched yet. Like, how do you handle all that layered risk? Because your thesis on Solana is faster, but the thesis on ETH is it can also be solved by L2s if this app implements it.
Oh, yeah, good question. I don't have a perfect answer for that. I mean, certainly you could say, hey, look, I invested in, for instance, Arbitrum and Immutable X, which is using Starkware, and Diversify, which is using, you guys did too. Like, hey, like in some capacity, like L2s bring much more throughput and speed and lower cost. And you have the more hardened, battle-tested security of Ethereum, where Solana still has, you know, has a decent validator set, but not fully there, I would say. I know some people might take object to that and fire back. But ultimately, I mean, I think back to our first episode, I remember you asked me this question. I said, look, I think the world is just going to evolve it's going to be a multi-galaxy world, multi-chain world. It has to be. Like gaming and NFTs, not everything needs to be suited in one type of environment. Not only that, but like, I think, you know, for instance, a lot of developers in Solana are not Solidity developers. So you would think that most people like, oh, it's attracting talent from Ethereum to Solana. No, it's actually a lot of financial guys that just build and come from Solana. Like a lot of guys from Chicago, and I think the gravitas with Sam and Serum. And like, I think like ultimately it's super net positive, but I think, yeah, like ultimately games, and there are different types of applications that are better suited for other protocols, or just to your point. I mean, it might attract different users. Like the onboarding funnel that you might have with Solana is much, much different. Heck, you can buy a smart chain. Like I'm not dismissive on any of this stuff, but ultimately, I mean, crypto is a speck of dust in any sort of industry. So you almost want to have a million funnels. Doesn't matter where they come from. Just hook them, bring them in. Whether it's central bank digital currencies, Facebook's coin, whatever. But once you open that door, it's really hard to go back. It's really hard to get your mind off of it. So when I take that view, it's like, all right, I'm just going to, I think invariably you have to make these investments because look, I mean, I think like in game theory, like a lot of people in the traditional operating assumption and way to operate is that most things are win-lose. And that's just like a really bad way to, I think, approach life in general. It's like most things are win-win. Like technology has created so much surplus that it is win-win, right? Facebook doesn't dominate the entire world. Of course, it's like perhaps the best social network, but you have Yandex in Russia because Russia, like, people love Yandex, that's fine. And in China, you have all different social networks. You know, ultimately, the key word here is consumer preference. You're creating a lot of consumer surplus with crypto, with technology, and invariably, people want the freedom of choice, and they're gonna maybe use one or two or three different applications, not just one.
I love your answer. And the way I asked the question was a very narrow, simplified phrasing of, you know, will financial services win on Solana or ETH L2s? And basically that's just a rush for whether Solana could launch them or whether ETH L2s will support them. But doesn't the game theory work in Solana's favor in this scenario in a way? And I'm not trying to pit Solana against Ethereum. I'm just trying to talk about communities here. If Solana is able to attract all of the top tier financial talent from Wall Street, from Chicago, from around the world, these guys, don't get me wrong, the guys in Ethereum, the girls in Ethereum are incredibly smart people. But if they're able to attract the smartest traditional financial people in the world, the game theory means all the next waves are all going to follow them in, build financial apps, plug in with them. Doesn't that mean that like you would want to just invest in financial apps and Solana? Like the game theory on the communities has to be very different.
Possibly. But I'll tell you why at the moment I still remain much more bullish on Ethereum. Because so when Binance Smart Chain was happening, right? You saw that chart from, oh, wow, there's more users now on PancakeSwap than Uniswap. You're like, well, shit, no one cares about decentralization. This is taboo to talk about. Like, will people ever care about decentralization? I don't know. There's a credible version of this universe where most people are just like, you know what? Look at stablecoins, right? Most people use USDC. Crypto has always been a world of double standards, right? It's like, yes, kumbaya decentralization, but even everyone I know, most, you know, it's like you use USDC and you become complacent. And you look, I think like that's the state of the world that we're in, right? And so what I'm trying to say is, back to the Binance example, to me it was, well, one, would people care about decentralization? Two, I think ultimately the criticism was, look, Binance Smart Chain is telling you most people don't care about decentralization and security. They just care about lower fees. And if they're going to get it in PancakeSwap and Binance Smart Chain or Solana, that's it. Like it's a consumer wins, like users win. And that ultimately is what matters most. It's sort of like the VHS Betamax model, right? Betamax was a better technology. Ultimately, VHS won because it was better marketed. Now, okay, Binance Smart Chain, huge distribution of Binance. The problem that I have with this is this. In finance, in money, you know, you, the end user, might not care about this stuff. But most users, like in a steady state, 2-3 years down the road, where you have like broad adoption, right? Because we're here, because we think that's going to be the case. So if you assume that, then you say, well, hold on a minute. Most users are never going to interact directly on chain. They're going to come from aggregators, right? Even JP Morgan's of the world. They might not even know that they're using blockchain. They might just, every application in their phone is going to use DeFi. Okay, fine. Let's just assume that's the state of the world. Well, I'll tell you who's going to care about security. JP Morgan. The aggregator is going to care about security, right? And immutability and certainty behind that, right? And so that begets more liquidity, and liquidity begets more liquidity, and it's more efficient. And so that is the flywheel that Ethereum is on at the moment, right? You look at why PayPal or why Visa or you know, is settling in USDC on Ethereum. Now, and that's the reason, right? Because they don't want the egg in the face. And security becomes super important, ultimately, for the big players that are aggregating users and going to interact on chain. That's what's going to matter. And it's going to be interesting. Aave Pro Markets, Compound Chain. These things, I think, are being built on, I guess Compound Chain is like a substrate fork. And Facebook is a fork of, what is it, Cosmos, Tendermint. But yeah, at the moment, most of the users aren't Ethereum. Most of the developers aren't Ethereum. And it has the highest security, like the most Lindy. Now, the last criticism I've heard is like, look at what's like Taproot and Bitcoin could in some theory, that's moved more towards and like Sovereign and all these different applications and build. Like, it's possible, right? I'm not dismissing it. So anyways, longer than answer, but I think liquidity, security gets more liquidity, and it's a very virtuous flywheel that we're in. It doesn't mean that it can't be disrupted. But at the moment, I think you want to play in both, ultimately. No maximalism on Ethereum or Solana is going to work. I think you just need to be open-minded and playing in both fields. Because you're going to interact a lot. There's going to be a lot of value transfers between both chains, I think.
No, it's a fantastic answer. I never thought about the security from the aggregator or type side of things. That actually is a really interesting answer. And I guess, how do you think about investing, though? I mean, like, obviously, you don't want to just invest in Ether Solana, right? You want to invest in, like, the app layer here. How do you think about sizing bets? How do you think about, you know, concentrating those? I mean, I already kind of asked that question, but it is like a really tough balance, man, because there aren't like, even though you have five niches that you might want to fill, like you opened with, they might not be available on Solana yet. Maybe you have to build them. Maybe you have to find the teams. Maybe they're available on ETH, but not at the right valuations. Like, it's just such an art to craft your portfolio.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think I won't talk specifically what we do with Parify, because that's a little bit proprietary, I guess. I've talked about it before, I got in trouble. but hypothetically, I would say that a money market is going to be built on Solana. So you look at who's going to build it, right? And I found Jet. There we go. A options protocol is probably going to be built on Solana. So you replicate a lot of the components that have been built and successful in Ethereum, right? And you say, reasonably speaking, you need to have certain core backbone, like money Legos, in a layer one to function. That's what led me to a column, for instance, in Polkadot. To your point around like how I think about investing in layer one, like ETH or Sol versus applications, I tend to skew more the application layer. I think it's a levered bet on a particular L1. So I, for instance, don't own, I wasn't as gung-ho on dots, but I do like, for instance, Akala. And by the way, none of this financial advice. I was just like giving a hypothetical example. But in terms of sizing, I think in categories, like in themes, right? I think pillars of finance, users, and like gaming, and like I have this sort of different maps in my mind that I think, okay, this should be at least 2 or 3 or 5% of the portfolio. And then I'll make bets accordingly. I may make one bet, I may make 5 bets, I may make 3 bets. It depends. But yeah, I think it's ultimately an exercise of triangulating to how big do I think this opportunity is? How big do I think like an options protocol, how much demand is there at the moment? And it's all very relative, right? It's like, do you, for instance, in Solana, right? It's relatively early. Do you want to invest in an options protocol right now, or would you rather invest in money market? Because I think you need one to get the other. So there's kind of a sequence to things. Like you could look at Synthetify and Mango, which is great, you know, which is, I think, two good teams. But then you can also look at Jet. And so I think one has less risk than the others because they've worked. They're very proven. That's what kind of led me to Aave early on. I'll give you an example. So like I met Sunny at DEF CON and I said, well, you have an example of Compound. It had raised a ton of money. Great team. You're like, I just don't think that there should be one money market because, you know, they're probably going to be slower in onboarding collateral. There's going to be a number of reasons. It's just, there's an opportunity to create, you know, it's not a winner take all market. And then so invariably that kind of, you go back to a drawing board and say, okay, it should be sized as a whole. Money market should be X percent of the portfolio. And then within that, I'm going to slice it in one or two or whatever.
That's a good answer. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about token incentives. How do you think through, and it's a very broad question, but how do you think through token incentives, I guess, for the team, for users, for projects using their token to incentivize and maintain a community and help promote the actions that they want to grow the project? Like we've seen so many examples of projects mess this up. We've seen so many successes. How do you think about this from an investor lens and maybe also as a user?
Yeah, look, I'll give you a very concrete example. Yearn, perfect example, I think. Yearn, fair launches, fascinating. I think like, it was like, wow, you literally created what is perhaps the purest community since Bitcoin, not even Ethereum, Bitcoin. Like it was just remarkable how the community coalesced because it was super powerful to see someone so like, I don't know what the right word is, but like Andre just sort of like gave the protocol to the people and everyone like was like, it ties into so much of what we discussed, right? It's like people rallied behind that in a way that you didn't, I thought that was like, this is super special. And to me, that was like, we're early in Yearn. And I was like, this is really powerful. I was in Discord. And I was like, something, you're seeing something here that is not found somewhere else. But of course, like it wasn't perfect, right? Because you sort of like exhaust your tokens and they were all distributed. And fortunate enough to be in the Doers group. I am the Doers group, which is like a small group of core contributors in Yearn. And I first proposed on chain to change the structure to do a 220 kind of model where more value would accrue to strategists and to the team. And of course, it was like, you know, Andre's not like, he would be the first one to tell you. He was like, no, like, I'm not like a business person. Like, I just want to build cool tech. And that's it. And I'm like, yes, but you need to, for me, what I was worried about is like the devs, look, if you don't have skin in the game, you at some point will want to go elsewhere.
He is an outlier, somebody that is extremely altruistic beyond incentives.
That's the right word I was looking for. And I admire that. But at some point, you need to build a team. And at some point, people need to put food on the table and be valued for their contributions. It's just human psychology. Anyone that I'm not a believer that people just do things out of the goodness of their heart. I think humans are good species. But at some point, you have an opportunity cost. It's just, it is. And so I was there and saying, look, guys, we need to give you, like, we need to restructure and mint more Wi-Fi to give to the team. Because they started losing devs to another.
That was
protocol.
A big decision. That was not an easy decision for those that weren't around.
Not,
it was not easy.
It was like we minted 6,666 Wi-Fi, which was not a small number in creating vesting packages and incentive structures. But I will tell you, immediate change. Well, you could just sense the energy in the group was very different. Very, very different. And I think, look, was it perfect? No, probably not. I think TBD, like, can we improve the vesting schedules? Maybe, like, nothing's perfect, but I think we constructed something that borrowed a lot of elements from traditional vesting packages in startups and in the traditional world. And saying, look, if you leave, you're not gonna earn all of this. You're gonna get clawed back, and you need to earn it, right? And so it's just very simple, like, parameters. But it's been great because Yearn has been able to, I think, attract more strategists, build more products, and a lot of the team is just the energy is way different. So that's just one very concrete example.
No, that's an incredible example. I mean, incentives are absolutely key. incentivizing people to bring good strategies, which drive alpha, is the core of Yearn. So that makes a lot of sense. Do you think, though, that it's no project nails their token econ from day one? Because no. You never know what tokens you're going to need for future needs, future incentives, things like that. So a lot of this comes down to the ability for a community, or sorry, the ability for a team or a project to communicate this to the community in such a way that they're able to react and change things in real time. Yearn had a very straightforward need. Hey, we have a token cap. We need to print more for incentives. It's very straightforward. People know that the alpha dies if they're not incentivized. Mm-hmm. But do you think a lot of communities have the ability or the buy-in to do this? Because you do start to teeter on our original point was, is the founder just printing more tokens or is the community actually want this?
No, perfect. No, it's a really good question. I think my advice is, to new teams thinking about token structure is do not codify everything all at once because you just don't know how your community will evolve, how the protocol will evolve. And so directionally, the team should kind of retain 20, 30% maybe. Investors, if there are, sometimes they're not, like 10, 15%. And then you leave a lot of room for the DAO. And then I'm super bullish on DAOs. And then ultimately you bring on more people from the community to administer the DAO and to create pilot programs of liquidity mining, for instance, or incentives or referral programs or whatever it is your protocol is. If it's more consumer facing, you might want to have referral programs with distribution channels like Revolut and YRX or whatever, or even like exchanges or other protocols, protocol or protocol referral programs. You might want to have different liquidity mining programs. So for Aave, we proposed the first liquidity mining program and it was a beta for 90 days. The good thing is that Aave initially, when I was constructing like the Aavenomics, and I think you guys were part of it too, with Stani, it was like, let's leave some room to use this as a war chest to adapt and to, for user acquisition, for strategic reasons, for acquisitions, whatever, right? It's sort of the treasury. That's super valuable. And other protocols just codified all at once. It's like, this is going to be for X and liquidity mining Y, and that's it. And so they really have very little maneuverability, malleability in their token structure. Ultimately, you want to have the ability to test different programs. Like UMA is doing some really cool stuff with options, like milestone-driven liquidity mining programs. Like fantastic. Like I think the way UMA has done there, they retain a lot of tokens in the treasury and they've done all these different experiments like A-B tests. And I think that's fascinating. Like that's what you want to be doing because you can do all these really cool experiments and say, hey, is this the right structure or liquidity mining program? And then you test it for 3 weeks or you test it for 6 months or you test it for 3 months and then you go back to the drawing board. And I think that's probably the more sensible kind of way to structure these things, leave a lot of room for the DAO. It also allows, like Index has been a great protocol too, where you've seen the community grow and you pay contributors out of the DAO and people rise to the occasion and creates really good community. So all these different examples, but I think ultimately, yeah, it's very tempting to try to codify. I think the community, when you're like reading that Medium post, that Twitter thread of here's the liquidity mining program or here's the token structure and economics. Yes, there's a continuum. People want some certainty on monetary policy, but absolute certainty is probably going to hinder and handicap your ability to be in a position of strength.
I'm with you. The putting anything in concrete terms to me feels like you're agreeing to maximalism from day one. Like, I feel like you have to be malleable. Yeah. The other question I have for you is, I mean, we work with a lot of teams, as you know, but how have you changed your process for working with a team? I mean, when I first got started in crypto, I had so many opinions. I'd hop on the call, I'd talk for 60 minutes or 59 minutes, I would talk for a minute. Now I feel like it's totally reversed where I'm just listening. Like when you work with Stani, for example, like what's your process? Why do they want to keep coming back to work with you? Like, do you listen? Do you give advice? How forceful are you? Walk me through that.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to ask Stani that. But I quite simply want to be the first person someone calls when shit hits the fan or whenever. I want to be the first call, first person they talk to, first person they think about. And it's ultimately building trust because I want to make sure that they know that I don't expect things to be perfect. We're all humans. We all have, you know, and things are going to, there's going to be fires to put out during the morning. And I think just being responsive, being there, I built a great relationship, for instance, with Kane's brother, Kieran, from Alluvium. I don't know, man. Like he just called me and Kane was like, hey, my brother's building something. And I had a good relationship. I have a good relationship with Kane. And so it's just being there. You know, I think founders, it can be pretty lonely at the top. It can be pretty lonely being a founder. A lot of it is listening. You're right. Like, I think the best advice, life advice that I've got is don't give advice. Just listen. Because like, don't be prescriptive. The doctor writes, hey, you need this. That's the worst thing you can do, right? Because to me, no path is the same. And what's worked for one protocol might not work for the other. It's totally different situations, totally different market environment, totally different stage of the protocol or whatever, right? And so the worst I think you can do as an investor or just generally is to go in there and say, hold on a minute, guys, this is how it's going to be done. Because it's probably not the right approach. It's more so, you know, I think Alan, or ultimately I want to be investing in someone that is really talented and just needs some guidance and some kind of a rebound, like a sounding board to help. And then my approach is they have a whiteboard with stuff that they can't get to, they don't want to get to, they're punting. I want to know what that is. And I'll go to work there. And so Sonny at one point called me and said, hey, I want to get to Elon Musk. I was like, well, this is a little bit tricky. But let me get to work. And somehow, I don't want to say if I got them or not, but that's the kind of stuff, you know, that like, I don't know, like, I was like, Sonny, you really outdone yourself here. You're putting me in a tight spot. But I want to be, you know what I mean? Like having that confidence, be like, all right. The other thing I'll say is most times a lot of founders don't ask for help or ask for help too little too late. So it's an encouragement to like use your investors. Like we're here, we're part of the community. Like I know there's a lot of criticism around VCs and like just extracting value and all this stuff, but I'm not mine. I think you guys are very helpful. Whenever I mean, not to be a shadow or anything, like you know this, like whenever I talk to founders, I like club deals because I don't want to be taking the entire allocation. Now, this is an perhaps the best advice I'm going to give right now is to a founder, don't do a round with one investor only. It's the worst thing you can do.
I couldn't agree more.
I understand there's a Sequoia model, and that Sequoia, for instance, is notorious for just blocking everyone out. In crypto, A, it's a very founder-friendly environment, and two, any investor that thinks that they can provide all of the value is hallucinating.
Oh my God, it's so dumb because your VC's investors are your users. Like I'll never send, perfect example. The Optimism team is fantastic. I'm an investor in Arbitrum. Where am I going to send a project to build on an L2? I'm going to send them right to Arbitrum all day long.
I'll give you an example. Look, yeah. I didn't get an allocation in Optimum. I like the team, I like the opportunity. I didn't
fantastic
get
team. Fantastic
and
team.
You know what? Didn't either. I invested in Arbitrum. And guess what? Every single protocol that I'm an investor in, most of them are deploying in Arbitrum.
Oh, yeah, same. And there's nothing wrong about the team or the projects building on Optimism, but it's just a bias that comes into play when there's not a party round. Why would you help? You know, it's not to point out a specific example. It's just that if you're taking all of the round, it's not a community-led project.
Yeah. And look, it's not a threat. You know, it's not to say that if you don't give me an allocation, I'm going to sabotage your protocol.
No, absolutely not.
Like, I don't want it to come across like that. I think that, look, ultimately, the worst in crypto has always been this tribalism bullshit that, you know, ultimately, everyone outside is looking for excuses to put down crypto. Oh, you know what? This founder went away with all the money. It was a rug pull. Oh, this fund blew up. And, you know, people are always looking for excuses to minimize crypto and its potential. So that's still the state of the world that we're at. Most investors are critical. And you know what? That's great because I love that because that's the people that I'm betting against. And that's to this day, it's like, what do you believe in? The others don't, but will in 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years time. Well, it's this, right? Because it creates all this tension. And that's great. You know, it's a very contrarian bet. It still is. But as an industry in crypto, I think we can do a much better job of just supporting each other. And that's my philosophy. This goes back to a lot of the questions that you asked me is ultimately, I want to push innovation forward. And that involves investing in people and founders, wherever they may come from, whatever they look like, whatever problem they're attacking. If it's a passionate founder and a good person, I'm going to invest behind it. And I think anyone that takes object to that, I'm sorry, but that is just my philosophy, my principle. But yeah, like I think like founders should really select and curate their investors and use that to their advantage. And it's sometimes saddening to see that just, you know, I won't name funds, but I think we all know who they are. They are just a little bit more sharp elbowed. And I'm not one of those. And I think ultimately I like collaborating with you guys, with the framework guys. Like a lot of people think it's not competitive. Like ultimately it's so quite early and the competition really is outside.
Hell man, if I get on a community call and I don't see like the funds I love on there, it's boring. Like I love seeing you on a call with a team. Like it's fun, man, because you know, it's just like, it's collaborative, it's exciting, you share stories, you build together. It's not just like you and a team, it's like you and the community, and then you open it up. And you know, hell man, I get on calls and I am definitely not the Delphi guy that should be on the call. So I don't join them anymore. And I drag someone else that is, and they're excited about it. Like that's the whole point of the community-oriented approach.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Santiago, other questions for you. This is fantastic. How skeptical are you when you're doing due diligence on a project? I know that you form your thesis, you know that there's holes you want to fill, but how hard do you go on that first call? Do you jump right to problems, red flags, or do you start off with the rainbows?
I don't know. I think I'm all over the place, to be honest. Sometimes I tend to be really critical. And admittedly, sometimes it's because it's a very competing protocol. And I was just like, all right, why X or Y? Or why this or that. when it's more frontier stuff, I'm not as critical. Because a lot of times it's just an idea, it's just a thesis. And, you know, how critical can you be of something that doesn't have a lot of substance behind it? It's more like getting to know the founder. But yeah, like I in the first call, I tend to just get to a state where the founder is doing most of the talking. And then I can go back to him with more perhaps like targeted clinical questions. But yeah, my degree of skepticism, I don't know. That's a good question for, maybe I'll ask founders this, like how skeptical I am on a relative basis relative to other founders or other investors. How skeptical are you? Over the last 2 years, do you think that you've grown in the first calls or just generally in your DD process? More skeptical, less skeptical, neutral, no change?
I'm glad you threw it back. I mean, I'd say I've grown way more skeptical pre-call and less skeptical on the first call. So more curation. And then once I'm on the call, I'd love to meet them, dive in. Because frankly, like I like talking to people, I love making friends, but like who the hell's going to tell you their story if you just get off the bat and hate them?
Yeah. That's so true. I think you're right. Like, so two things I think. One is there's sometimes fatigue. It's like, oh, you're looking at the 10th option protocol. It's like, oh, okay, well, and that kind of implicitly just makes you a little bit more skeptical, I think, naturally. The other one is you have these trusted nodes. So like you, Tom, you're like, hey, you introduced me to NFT protocol recently. So I was like, okay, it's coming from someone that I built and have a working relation. I know you, I trust you. You're like a trusted node in my group that if I get a deal from you, it's much different, right? And so I'm much more open to that. And maybe it's a good point. It's like, how do you solve for when it's not coming from your trusted node? Because there have been really good investments that just don't come from your trusted X or Y, you know?
Glad to be node man and you are as well. And Santiago, a couple minutes before we close out, let's get to some fun stuff. What's the best advice that you give other people?
I think I mentioned it before, but one is thinking probabilities. Everything. You just can never think in absolute terms. And the minute you think that you understand something or that it's too obvious, it's probably not. It's probably arbed out. So you always, I think, constantly, because I think thinking in probabilities does two things. One, it always, a probability changes over time. I think it's not static. And I think that forces you to constantly process new information to assess the state of that probability. And I think that's the kind of thing that touches on a lot of things that we've talked about. So that would be my best advice. The second one is, and I know I'm cheating because you said one, is I love this book, Siddhartha. And it really is just this idea that like no path is the same. And crypto can be difficult because you look at very successful people and it's noise and it can be troubling. And I remember my first time when I walked in, I moved to like San Francisco, Silicon Valley. I'm like, oh man, I'm like getting a coffee. And like the Google guys are like next to me ordering coffee. And you're like, wow, like this guy is not too dissimilar in age and is just incredibly more successful and done incredibly, like so much more things than I have. And there's two approaches to that. One is you get frustrated and you get somewhat like, I don't know, it just puts you in a bitter state and paralyzes you. And the other one is, no, you know what? Through osmosis, I'm going to be part of this community, which is Silicon Valley or crypto, and try to contribute to the best of my ability because something good will come out of that. And I think that's just like being a piece that, you know, I don't want to say your time will come or the harder you work, the luckier you get. I don't know. There's a lot of luck to things. There's skill, there's luck, there's timing, but just being a piece that some things fall outside of your control. And when you understand that certain things will fall outside of your control, then you focus on the things you can control and really, really drive those. Whether you're investing in the protocol, there's things that just you never will control. When I make an investment, I always know there are two or three things that I can control and I'll drive maniacally to that to kind of drive through the wall and make it a successful, like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I just know that there's things that I won't be controlling. So I direct my energy to the things that I can control and being a piece that the path towards success is very different for everyone. And so you can't try to copy other stuff because it's just going to be, a fruitless endeavor.
I love that. I love that focus. I mean, it's hard because there's people in crypto that you and I know worth zillions of dollars. And I mean, waking up every day and trying to work when you know that they've reached that level of success is hard. But to your point, if you worry about that all day, you're never going to be successful in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Never. No. I love that. That's fantastic advice. And flipping this on its head, I guess what's the best advice you've ever been given?
There's so many because I've made a number of mistakes over my life.
It's not an easy question because, I mean, it could be life. It could be crypto.
Yeah.
It's not an easy one.
Yeah. I vividly remember this is the first thing that's coming to mind. I don't know if it's the best advice that I've gotten, but I was getting ready for a super day. I was at JP Morgan at the time and I was interviewing at this like venture shop, VC shop. And it was like super day. I was kind of nervous and And I prepared so much. I hadn't been sleeping for like 3 days. I was like doing investment banking. So I was like really sleep deprived. I was really like eating at me that I was like, I don't, you know, it was like this impulse of like, I think I could be doing more to prepare because this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity. I felt at the time. So I was like, am I doing enough to prepare myself? Because if I don't win, I will never forgive myself. You know what I mean? Like that state where you're saying I can always do more and you're not sleeping. And you're like, there comes a point where you're like, actually it's hurting you, right?
I've been there, man. That Wall Street atmosphere is toxic.
Yeah. But even in crypto, right? Like a lot of founders, like you're always on, right? 24/7. So the advice that I got was from a good friend of mine who's an analyst with JP Morgan. His dad is like super successful private equity. And says, look, calm down. They are not looking for someone that knows the answers for everything. They're looking for someone that is not going to whiff. When he gets asked a question, they're going to ask you questions that you're not supposed to know the answers. What they're testing you on is, are you going to be the person and how you respond and say, try to come up and whiff the answer? Or are you going to be saying, look, have the confidence to say, I don't know, but this is how I would do it. Or just say no. And to me, that was like, it gave me a lot of peace of mind. And it has to this day because crypto is so multidisciplinary and just things in general, like the world at this moment in time through technology and dissemination of information is moving at a pace that I don't think your brain is possible. Like you cannot compute and process all this stuff. And it goes back to having focus and saying, I'm not going to know everything. I'm not supposed to know everything. And so I think that the conduit to that is just having more intellectual curiosity of being at peace that you're not going to catch them all. It's not a game of Pokemon and you're not supposed to know the answer to everything. But what you can do is reach out to people that are more knowledgeable than you and focus on a process of acquiring information that becomes more efficient over time. Because I think that's what you can do because you're never going to be the supercomputer. It's not going to work. It's going to be overload of information. So it's that comfort and peace of saying no. No to certain things, to I don't want to take this call, I don't want to take this meeting, to no, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry, I'll go back and find it. So it's that, right? We're so conditioned, yes, yes, yes. It's just times where it's just no.
Again, incredible advice on not getting jaded and caught up in others and focusing on you so that you could outperform what you're good at. And two, not having to know everything and just, and that also allows you to focus on what you want to do and solve problems.
What I'll say is like, so many people focus on the outcome, focus on the process because the process you can't control. The outcome is a lot of like variables that are outside of your control. There's a lot of noise. And so the process you can most definitely control.
Yeah, no, process makes perfect, man. I love that. And I guess on this kind of, deep question topics, mental health, taking breaks, not getting burnt out, being here for the long game. How do you get away? How do you disconnect? How do you make sure you don't burn out?
Yeah, honestly, it's a great question because I think it's super important for everyone. For me, it's exercise. I love running and like swimming and cycling. And so like a triathlon or whatever. But yeah, like it's just important to, or whatever it may be, taking an interest in like just like walks. There's certain things that you know, like you do that just spur a creative part of your brain that when you're in the job and day-to-day doesn't. So for me, it's exercise. It's like swimming or I'm running. And I know you love house music. I love house music too.
Yep.
love house music. So everyone has a good playlist. DM me, put it on Twitter. I'm not popular enough or cool enough to be on Tom's private Telegram.
Oh man,
group.
I didn't know you were not in there. I'm adding you right now. Damn, I thought you were in there, man.
No, I haven't made the cut. Jeez. But it's fine.
No, I'll add you in. This is a good way. I like
it. I'm just putting you on the spot. This is I was saving this till the very end.
I can't believe you're not in there, man. I'm kind of shocked, actually.
I even tweeted at you about this, but anyways, I'm not holding you accountable. But yeah, there are a few songs that just put you in a state that is just amazing. So, you know, the conjure up memories, to me, that's like awesome. So yeah, it's not so much about like taking like, so I'm in Europe now and these people take all of August, everything in Europe shuts down in August, which I guess we knew, but like, I think like more frequent breaks on a Saturday, a Sunday, a Wednesday, to me, it's just more useful. So you can't be off like the desk for a month, I guess. But like,
so you know, what do you, those are great points. I mean, the biggest thing I wrestle with is just the hour or two of my day where I wake up to 9,000 messages. In your opinion, how do you deal with that? Like, have you noticed that it's actually worth automatically replying to everything? Like, how do you deal with that influx?
You don't, I guess. The problem is, here's the problem. That if you don't respond, you think that your reputation can go to shit. If you don't respond in a minute, you're like, you're not going to be as much of a value add of a VC. And it's like, what have you done for me lately? And I don't have a perfect answer for that.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
I just, You know, I think, yeah, there comes, I mean, there's like 1,000 unread Telegram. If I haven't responded to you, I'm sorry. Like, I'll plan to get to it. We're a team of four. So like, you know, have been sleeping for the last 9 months, I guess. I don't think you have either. No. But no, but you know, like, I think, look, airlines give you the best advice. You got to put your oxygen mask before helping others. And I think like, if you get to a point where it becomes, crypto is a lot of fun, a ton of fun. There are moments where you say there's a lot of bullshit and you're like, I don't like this. I don't like this behavior. I hate rug pulls. I hate all this. But you know what? I look back and say, well, shit, I don't know what I'd be doing. I have other options, of course. But like, I always go back to crypto because I think the smartest guys are here. It's the hardest problem. It truly is like the most social, like the most powerful socioeconomic transformation since the Industrial Revolution. I believe it. That's why I'm here. It's not perfect. And so like, ultimately I zoom out and I say, okay, like, I just need to prioritize certain things because it's always, otherwise you start feeling that it's very much like pull and people are, you start being bitter and people become needy. And as soon as that, it's never about them, right? I think people in their good heart reach out to you because you're a beacon of light. You give them insights. People like talking to you. And I think if you're going to respond and just be quick, it's better to just, hey, look, it's, I think better calm down, go for a run, do whatever, come back and say, and respond with mental clarity and a disposition to actually talk to people.
That's a great piece of advice.
Just don't respond. Just don't respond. If I'm not responding to you, it's because I'm doing other shit. I'm doing other stuff. Just know that I most likely see your message and I will respond at the right time that I feel is where I can help you the most. That's it. And if you don't believe that, then I'm sorry. Like that's on you, not me.
Yeah. No, that's an incredible heuristic for when you get inundated, when you should respond. My last question for you, you've already answered throughout the interview a couple times on like misses, you know, why. I'd like to take the other side of that. What was a winner for you that gave you a sense of accomplishment beyond the monetary gains, beyond the percent gains? What's a play that changed the world, changed your life, changed someone else's life for you?
It was Avid for me. So I met Stani DevCon in Osaka. And I looked at the booth. I said, not only do they have the coolest gear, it was a ghost. I still have it. I'm going to wear it in Paris. I'm a rocket fan. I don't typically get gear, but I saw the booth and I said, there's something here. It was Eflin at the time. And to me, it encompasses a lot of the things that we've touched on, which is having a thesis on money markets, seeing a team that had been building through a brutal bear market, not giving up, and just candidly, human capital alone is valued more. I mean, when I looked at it, it's a 10 million market cap. I was like, the value of these guys is worth more than that. And I said, I flew back from Japan. It was like a typhoon. Got back to San Francisco and said, I just need to buy as much Aave as I can possibly get my hands on. And look, Stani's become one of my closest friends. Because we've worked so closely together. He's a great guy. The entire Aave team, I think, is remarkable what they've done. And it really shows you that, look, Aave was zero TVL in January of last year.
God damn. Wow.
It has 23 billion now.
Jesus.
18 or something. And it really encompasses the, is it going to be the dominant money market? I hope so. I think we're doing everything that we can. But it encompasses a lot of how I like to work with teams, get really close with them, build trust, iterate, experiment, and have an open mind. And I think they're building incredible, like none, this is not a shell to Aave. I think there's so many good protocols, but to me personally, Sai personally has become a very close friend of mine. And I love that because ultimately I think when I make an investment, it's like my family. I'm going to do everything in my power to make it a success, not be like an imposing micromanaging father that it pisses you off. No, just like be there, help them. And it's been remarkable to see their growth. And I think, look, they're doing some really cool stuff.
Santiago, that's an excellent answer. And not to cut you off, but do you think you can ever get that again? Because, I mean, at the size of Parify, at the size of, you know, your weight now, it, you know, a 10 mil valuation means you could only really inch in 10 grand or 50 grand of liquidity if you're lucky over time. Like, you can't build that big of a position. Do you think, like, you can still get that level of feeling and success and accomplishment out of taking a position in something that might be $1 billion in valuation?
Yeah, there's an Aave out there right now that I'm not catching and I'm looking for it. There is every year. You have to make one Aave every year. Yeah. There is one out there. You know it. It was actually for you guys. It was something that I know it was multiple, right? There are out there. And it's just as Aave. I think there's a number of examples. I feel pretty excited about a couple of investments I made this year that I think have the potential to be that Aave-like, more on the frontier, more on like out of favor, not so much of a really good team. Hey, look, maybe it could be this play to earn stuff like Yield Guild. Fascinating. I think it would be even more explosive than Uber. Like shit, you're transforming game structures and the problem with half-life and engagement. I mean, it's massive in-game economies. Like you're kind of changing the way people relate to money and entertainment and labor. Like, it's just, this is what I think. Again, there are certain mega trends that people, I think, haven't truly kind of woken up to. And I think play to earn is one of them. Not because Axie is like super popular now, but you would have seen it. Like, there's a lot of engagement. It's not just a narrative of like, oh, you're giving people employment. No, it's not just that. It's like, you know, you look at Fortnite and what it's cranking out, and then you're seeing certain metrics in these protocols. You're saying, wait a minute, there's kind of a disconnect here. There should be a re-rating. So there's always an Aave out there. Always. I think that's why we're here.
The funny part, though, is like, you're like, the life-changing investments have these groundbreaking mythical theses, right? Like, for us, Axie, play to earn, you know, Thorchain, cross-chain. Like, I'm just bringing it back to me because it's what I know. But do you have that level of thesis before or after you make the investment? Because obviously, in hindsight, it's easy. But, you know, the 98th investment for Parify, like, you know, is that going to move the needle? I don't know. But having like a very concentrated bet, I think play to earn is going to reinvent the fabric of gaming. It's going to bring people in from all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like, having that level of a thesis early on will change, will return. Fun.
Yeah, I mean, I've been surprised how quickly Aave has grown. I don't think in my wildest upside case did I envision it growing as it did. I structure an investment having to put myself in a position where I can be very patient to see the ultimate thesis. But of course, the hardest thing that we do, I think, is like, it's liquid venture. And so, you know, things don't move linearly or in a simple trajectory. And yeah, I think like in many ways, I think of like, what would the first investor in Google have done if it was a liquid or Amazon? A venture is easy because you kind of have to hold the bag until an IPO or secondary, but it's difficult. It's very difficult, right? How do you manage risk? How do you size a position? How do you ongoingly manage a position? How do you manage risk?
Do you take money off the table as you go? Like something like Aave, incredible, literally hockey stick growth. How do you decide whether or not to cut part of that position? Is it just to fund other plays? Is it a risk metric? What is it?
The very clear one is if it becomes too big of a position, like naturally you just have to size down, but otherwise, unless constantly kind of reprocess, re-underwrite ingest new information. But yeah, I know it's difficult. It's very difficult. And look, I think like sometimes like you selling some of the position to manage risk doesn't mean that you're going to be less involved in a protocol.
That's a really good point. Santiago, I fucking love talking to you. I'm saying that just that I have to mark the explicit thing on iTunes.
Man. Yes.
I love talking to you. I learned so much. I'm so glad we met and we're friends.
Yeah, man.
Last question, more of a personal one. What's your favorite book on game theory that I could read?
Infinite and Finite Games by James Karst.
Infinite.
It's Finite and Infinite Games or Infinite and Finite Games? I always be confused. But it's James Karst. It's a very short book. It's like The Little Prince. It's a very short book. And it probably encompasses some of the best life lessons around playing iterated games or finite games. And I think in life and in business and in relationships, you always want to play the long game and an iterated game. And so, yeah, it's a really good book. I think you'll enjoy it.
Long games with long people, man. Santiago, thank you so much for being part of the series, man. Really appreciate it.
No, Tom, awesome. It's always good to be here. You're so thoughtful and I love your questions. So I really enjoyed the discussion. Thanks for having me.
Man. Of course, man.
We'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit Cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast.
With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.